Do it faster. I was asked by Marlene, and I may get it wrong, but this is what I understood the question to be in a lot of ways. What do we really make of some of the Bible stories? How do we understand it Jewishly? Do you understand it as stories whose main purpose is to make you a better moral person? You read the stories and you try to use them to figure out a way to be a better person in this world. Do we view them as claims about historical claims about things that really happened? And so they're like, no, it's faith that Noah, there was really an ark and held all the animals. So are they really about that? And then I guess it would be like having faith that this is the word of God. And so you're being tested in your faith if you don't find them to be true stories. Or are they something else? And so this is my quick answer. The idea that they need to be just one of those is foreign to the ancient mind. If someone says, is the Bible really philosophy, or is it history, or is it morality, or is it tribal epics? The answer is the ancients didn't distinguish. It's all mixed up together. And it's intertwined even in the same sentences and paragraphs. So what you have to think of when you think of the Torah, the Bible, in my opinion, is, you know, think of a village. You're living in a tribal village in Africa somewhere. And or a Native American reservation. Every now and then, the shaman comes out of the tent. The shaman lives, you know, in a weird cave on the edge of your village. And every now and then, the shaman comes out, and the shaman tells you about your tribal history. Once upon a time, the wolf god and the mother earth had a fight. And this was the creation of our people. And this happened, and that happened. And there was great chief Kogabawawa. And Kogabawawa won the great war. And they tell this history. And if you said to that shaman, and then they go back in their tent and don't bother them until the next time. They have to go on. What did they just do? They don't have the concept of history and moral telling and tribal this and epics. It is what it is. It's the ancient memory that is preserved. That's the shaman's function. The shaman's function is to preserve tribal memory. So I think of it as, the most simply put, is that the stories, the writings, the laws, this is our collective Jewish tribal memory. And it's all those things. I mean, it is some history and it is some morality. And sometimes they're all mixed up. And I'll give you an example. I mean, Cain and Abel. You know the story of Cain and Abel? They offer their offerings. God only likes Abel's. Cain kills him, and it's a sad ending. So, is it a morality tale? Well, I think so. It actually has one of my favorite lines, which I never even noticed. I studied it so many years, and I was talking to my father, who's a better rabbi than I am, and he said to me, well, you do know that, like, the moral of the story is right in the text. And I was like, you mean the brother's keeper thing? He's like, no, have you read the story? It's only a few sentences long. After Cain kills Abel, or it was before Cain kills Abel, I believe. So that's how much my memory. Abel's offering finds favor with God, and Cain's sacrificial offering does not. And it says that Cain's face was downcast, and his face fell. And God says to him, why are you so sad? Why are you so bereft? Cain says, why do you think? You accepted my brother's offering and you didn't accept mine. And God says, and I quote it badly, God says, it's not even like Moses related it. God says, some days God favors your offering. And some days God doesn't. And if you're going to base your happiness on that, you're walking down a road you don't want to walk down. I use this with a 10-year-old boy who lost his grandfather in a car accident and was really just brokenhearted. And I said, I'm so sad. And I said, you can't, and I read it with them. And I said, you can't, there are going to be good days and bad days. And if you're going to base your emotional state on the circumstances of each day, you're walking down a road of depression and of grief, and of never getting over things. In other words, I think this is probably better in a song or something, where it's like, you know, sometimes you eat the bear, and sometimes the bear eats you. I mean, like, sometimes good things happen, sometimes they don't. And God says right at the beginning of Genesis, I don't guarantee you every day is going to be a great day. Every day, you're going to find favor. And if you're going to be like, now I am sick unto death, now I got to kill my brother, that is defying God's basic rationale in the universe. So you can say it's a moral tale or an emotional tale or a homiletical tale. On the other hand, you could look in a different way, which is, because it's more things at the same time. What is, does anybody remember Abel's profession and Cain's profession? Don't say rabbi for Cain, even though I'm Rabbi Cain. Cain's profession is he's a farmer. What's Abel's profession?
Shepherd.
Now, have you ever noticed something in the Torah and the Jewish history? What profession was King David, the great beloved king of Israel? He was a shepherd boy. What was Moses doing at the burning bush? What was his profession? He was a shepherd. He was there with the sheep. What was Abraham's profession? Shepherd. What was Isaac's profession? Shepherd. What was Jacob's profession? Shepherd. You know, until Joseph got put in jail and sold by his brothers and became the minister of affairs in Egypt. And then still he brings over his family. They're all shepherds. Reuben, Levi, we're all shepherds. The whole tradition is based in shepherding. And all through the Torah and in general, there is a great skepticism of farming religion, a farmer religion, for a very basic idea. That, I mean, it's two very different ancient cultures. One is you pray for rain, because if you don't get rain, you die. You scratch out, like, Cain, what was Cain, you know, the punishment? Cain will have to toil, you know, but Adam's punishment too. You're going to have to toil and dig out your living from the earth. It's anxiety. It's pressure. It's hard work. It is a tireless work. At the end of the day, you can get a lousy harvest or a good harvest. You're subject to all the elements. A lot of fertility religions about, and magic is about making things happen, coercing those gods because I got to feed my kids. Shepherding religion is where the Psalms come from. Shepherding religion is you got your goats. You don't have a lot of professions. A lot of possessions. You're a nomad. You follow your goats. You live in a tent. You spend a lot of time just sitting there in nature, appreciating nature. You have a lot of time to think. You'll have a lot of time to play your flute or your lyre. And then the main principles are things like hospitality, welcoming people into your tent, and a connection to nature and the earth. Whereas farmers, the people who have the good lands, they get rich. The people who have the bad land become serfs on the lands of the rich because at some point they're going to have a bad harvest. They're not going to be able to pay their debts, says so in the Torah. And so at some point they're going to have to sell themselves to the people who are rich. Then what do the rich do? They control the police. They control the government. So the Torah has this whole critique that runs through it. And I didn't invent this. I mean, scholars. Scholars say there's a whole thing about farmers and shepherds. And one of the things that God's saying is, sorry, Cain, but that's not my, agriculture is not my thing. I think shepherding is like the cool profession. The lack of connection, the easygoing, the peace, the harmony, the music, the hospitality, the not worrying about, the more you own is just the more you have to carry. Shepherds hate carrying stuff, so it's not materialistic. Okay, so we go back to the original question, but that's just a good example. Is it history? Is it a moral tale? I think when the shaman says it, like the Moses who comes out and says, blah, 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 it's both. It's really, it has a moral dimension. It's not even necessarily related to the historical dimension. And all these things get wrapped up in it together. And most of the stories are like that. They have, if you say, did Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob really exist in approximately 1250 BC? Some people would say, those are such old tribal tales, they were probably myths. My view is kind of like, I mean, really, they had to make, I mean, it's hard for me to imagine someone sitting there and being like, we have to make up our tribal history. Let's invent someone called Abraham. I mean, look, did Abraham go on Mount Moriah and almost sacrifice Isaac? Let's put that aside for a second. But I'd say, why make up an Abraham in general? Why make up that our tribe had a guy named Abraham, had a son named Isaac, and a son named Jacob, and they ended up in Egypt? Like, I don't see why they would make that up. But are you telling me, if I found out that they made that up, would it mean I'd stop being religious? I think that someone got some of our ancient history wrong. Okay, it doesn't bother me that much. It's too many other things. for me to care that much. I don't stake my whole religion on it just being history or it just being a moral tale or just being this. I'm happy just to get it as the collective memories of our people. And then someone's like, wait, but you can't be religious if it wasn't all dictated on Mount Sinai by God in one go. Very interesting. Just this past Shabbat, I reread in Deuteronomy where Moses is saying what happened. And he said, you know what? I went up on, you know, because he's recounting what had happened back on Mount Sinai 40 years later. And in Deuteronomy this past Shabbat, he's telling everyone, he's like, you weren't alive back then. I'm going to tell you what happened. I went up there for 40 days and 40 nights. I didn't eat and I didn't drink. I communed with God and God handed me the Ten Commandments. He doesn't say that God handed me the whole Torah. And then he said, and then when I came down, I found out they built the golden calf. And I smashed the Ten Commandments and God was really angry. So I went back up and I spent another 40 days and nights fasting in order that God would forgive the people. It's still in the ancient world, as Pastor Demen can tell you, and you may already know, for a lot of religions, and in Judaism especially, even in the Talmud, fasting was something you did when bad things were happening and you wanted some grace from God. Just, it was like, there wasn't rain, you would fast. Something bad happened, you would fast. The Romans said, you all have to give us all your money. You would do some fasting. So I fasted for 40 days and night, and then God said, okay, you can have another tablet, and he gave me another set. He doesn't say, I spent 80 days and nights writing the Torah. So that one of the things is we have this conception, but it's all based on this divine revelation that had at Mount Sinai, but the Torah doesn't say that. The Torah says we got the Ten Commandments, and as I've said before, maybe to you, the Torah says, Vayomer Adonai el Moshe le'mor, and God spoke to Moses saying. But we also know that Vayomer doesn't necessarily just mean to speak, it can mean to think. And like we say in English, I said to myself. So that there are other words for think in Hebrew, but it is not uncommon in biblical Hebrew that instead of saying, I'm always using you, Pastor Deming, I apologize. Instead of saying, Pastor Deming thought that we were going to finish at 3, I could say, Pastor Deming said to himself we were going to finish at 3. That saying to yourself is thinking. And so that one way to say it is not that God was speaking out loud, but God made Moses think. And that is our tribal memory. Our tribal memory is that Moses delivered some of our ancient history that we had missed, some laws and some other things, and that these got supplemented by other scribes and other historians. And of course, people like me believe that that there wasn't just one shaman. Moses was big chief shaman, but Moses died, and there were other shamans. There were other history. When I say shaman, I mean the person who was in charge of holding our tribal history. And we actually know this. I mean, so I'm a modern person. Deuteronomy was clearly in charge of the scribes of the temple. And they're very the king's scribes. And so the king's scribes were very much in charge of the histories that were written into Deuteronomy. The priestly scribes were very much in charge of the history written into the book of Leviticus. And we know that. So there were multiple people writing down those memories. And one of the things that we see is they mostly are the same. And we get fascinated by the differences. If you're a scholar, you're like, ooh, 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 I found a difference. I found a difference. Deuteronomy says something different from Leviticus. And it's very exciting. You know what I mean? But the funny thing is, they're all very much the same. You look at the story of Noah and the Ark, right? One scribal history says that there was one pair of every animal. And one scribal history says there were 7 pairs of sacrificial animals. Because after all, you're going to need to make sacrifices, you're going to need to be poor animals. And we know that who do you think were the scribes of the 7 animals, the 7 pairs? The priestly scribes, because they're doing sacrifices, and they're thinking, wait a second, when we record our ancient history, they're going to need a few more animals. And the king scribes were probably like, oh, one pair is enough for the ancient story of the flood. So you can see little differences, but mostly they're the same. I have read the story of Noah and the Ark with Bible studies before, and people often don't realize that you see these little differences in it. And that's testament to the fact that, for the most part, the memories were very well preserved. And as you've probably studied before, I can finish with this, is that the human brain had a capacity to memorize things in the ancient world in a way that today is often lost outside of pre-literate cultures. Somehow when our brains evolved to write and record, we've lost the ability to memorize. But even today, if you go into Africa and places where they don't have writing, they can recount histories that are really long. I lived in Indonesia for 2.5 years after college, and I lived in a small village on the island of Java. And every, I don't know, maybe once, twice a year, they would stay up all night and build a campfire, and all the kids and all the local people in the village would get together, and they would have a shadow puppet or human performance of their ancient tribal history. And the interesting thing was that they had professionals who were usually really old men, and they were trained by their parents, and they were just local villagers missing teeth and all of that. And they would do this like 4-hour performance of saying the history. And sometimes they would use puppets, shadow puppets, to tell it. And sometimes people would act it out, which they call human puppet, which I love that. So you either got a human puppet performance or you got a shadow puppet performance. And so the question is, well, aren't they changing it? They have a way of learning the whole thing where they didn't get it wrong. So that I think that I call it our ancient memories. I find them largely trustworthy. And in fact, it was very popular in academia 15 years ago, 20 years ago, and 25 years ago, to definitely view the stories of the Torah as being fantasies created at a later time, an ancient myth constructed to understand our illustrious past. And then they did a lot of archaeology in Israel over the last 40 years, and they keep finding stuff that validates stories. They found the seal. They found the seal of the king's advisors, which are talked about in the book of Jeremiah. It was almost like Jeremiah planted them there for us to find to justify the historicity of Jeremiah. And King David. The word David just means beloved. Oh, there was a shepherd boy and Goliath. Give me a break. Great ancient tale to tell the kids for moral purposes. And then they dig up the city of David and they find evidence from that period of David's kingdom. And they find seals at Hezekiah's tunnel, and they find all this great archaeology, which to me doesn't mean, you see, God spoke it at Mount Sinai during those 40 days and nights that he was fasting. It doesn't make God right. It makes our memories of our elders and of our ancestors feel trustworthy. That's important to me. It's amazing to me how much has been found. And how much justifies it. The great final mystery is not Noah's Ark. It's the Bible says that 600,000 Jews, Israelites crossed the desert and spent 40 years there, and we don't find a lot of evidence. But the Hebrew word for thousand is Eleph. And in the Bible, Eleph also refers to a clan family of approximately 15 to 20 people. So a homestead houses an Eleph, a clan. And so when you think about it, if you multiply 600 times 20, you end up more, what I don't even know what it is, 12,000? You end up more with 12,000, which is a very realistic figure for about how many Jews would have left Egypt. So sometimes you read the Bible, oh, it's a bunch of myth. And even scholars say, it says 600,000. There was no archaeological evidence for 600,000. And then you realize, wait a second, if the word means clan, 600 clans, just about right. And then if it says, 2,000 people died over here, it might mean two clans died over there. So like you start to think, oh, the earth opened up and swallowed up thousands of people. It may mean that a couple of clans died under mysterious circumstances when God got angry. So that the more we read it, the more I do find it trustworthy, but not because it was spoken. It reaffirms my faith in something supernatural, but it reaffirms my faith in the power of my tribal elders to convey to me history that when reading it and spending time with it, it changes my life for the better. And Perla, I can't turn down Perla, but anyone who gets up and leave, you have my full appreciation and thank you for coming. And so Perla, can I ask?
Thank you for coming.
But no more big questions. Ask me the easy ones.
When you were talking about things that have been validated from
archaeology and scholars.
There was just something a few months ago about they figured out that there was an area where the story of the parting of the Red Sea made sense because in archaeological times, they saw a path where it was shallow, and at certain times of the year, the waters would come in and go out again.
So let's say Perla tells you this and she shows you the article. Does this reaffirm your faith, or does this reaffirm one's religiosity, or does it challenge it if you find out that there are certain natural circumstances under which the Red Sea parts and lets people pass through? So it wasn't a miracle. And maybe it wasn't a miracle. So is that a reason to say, so you see, Rabbi, that's why I don't come to synagogue, right? You believe in miracles and I believe in science. Or does it say, oh, this might have really happened? So for me, I'm more part of the latter. I'm part of, oh, it makes sense to me. Even Moses Maimonides, the author of the Great Code of Jewish Law, the Mishnah Torah, the leading rabbi of the Middle Ages. If you read him, what he says is, can there be miracles? And he says, God does not interfere with the course of natural events. The world is made up of science. Like the world, so God doesn't interfere. So, well, what's up with the Red Sea and all that stuff? And he says, holy coincidences. And that, I find, is a very good definition of a miracle for me, which is a holy coincidence, which is, you know, like, that's pretty amazing if we were running, and that's right when the Red Sea got its, that had the particular combination of things. And as Perlin knows, some of it's also connected with the plagues, whether it's the Red Nile and other things. Some of those are precursors to when the Nile has this weird thing where it lowers in certain areas. So for me, I actually just, I would say it reaffirms my faith, that these ancient stories actually were based on something. I'm not saying they got it exactly right. I'm completely wrong about this, but when you talk about Noah's Ark is so early, it's an ancient memory. I mean, it comes right after the Garden of Eden. And so I think Noah's Ark is based on something. Obviously, you know, it's not original to Judaism. It's in the Babylonian myths and the Assyrian myths. And I'm crazy. I think it was based on the Ice Age. I actually think humans were able to communicate some sense that all of Europe and Africa and the Middle East used to be covered in ice. Because it used to be. And that would be crazy. You're like, they can remember tens of thousands of years. I don't know. I just have the sense that, like, it's something about how all of everything, I don't think it was necessarily water. Anyway, I think there's some kernel of history in that, or something else about Noah's Ark. But do I actually think there was an actual ark? I think it's a talk about how people somehow survived that time, probably through migration, and how they also brought animals. I think there's a basis in that. I do, even though that's super ancient. And do I think there's a basis for the Garden of Eden? Well, that's an easy one. Because they tell it, this would make a terrible, what was that movie with Tom Hanks that did so well, that book about Jesus' wife? What was that, those movies always do so well. Anyway, it was already 15 years ago or something. Those novels that like tell you all these, I know, forget it. Okay, but it would make if you wanted to watch a movie called They Found the Garden of Eden, they figured it out, you don't need a whole complicated movie because it's right in Genesis chapter 2. It tells you where the Garden of Eden is. It's at the crux of the Tigris and Euphrates River, right near the Pitom thing, and I forget the fourth river. And so we know exactly where that is. And it just happens to coincide with where the very first grain was domesticated. It was originally a barley grain. We sometimes call it a wheat grain. And if you ever notice that in the Hebrew, it never says there was an apple. It says there was produce. And so I think it's pretty clear what the Garden of Eden is about. 15,000 BCE, at the corner of the Tigris and Euphrates River, the very first naturally growing domesticated grain happens. It was the beginning of farming. And it was the very end. It was the beginning of what they call the breadbasket of civilization. The cradle of civilization. So, like, I clearly think it's based on something. I don't think it was an apple. I think that's very medieval art. You know, the apple and something, and some angel saying, "Please don't eat it." You know, but the truth is, it was actually about the very beginning of civilization, where just happened to coincide with mental and cognitive evolution, where we went from not being able to remember, think, write, and other things to things like reflect, hold history, write, converse, which is exactly what the whole story is about. So I think they are based on real things, but I don't think just by learning the historical event they're based on, it enhances our understanding, but it doesn't replace it. And so what does it mean that we had an evolutionary shift in 15,000 BCE in ancient Babylonia? It means a lot. How did that change our lives? How did free will change our lives? How did gathering and farming communities where people were oppressed and enslaved as serfs, Torah is going to say, I have something to say about that. So it's about the moral implications of those historical actions.